Coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Those individuals that have a higher protein breakfast are much less likely to crave later on in the day and or go to the high satiety, highly palatable foods like you had mentioned for breakfast, like the French toast and the donuts later on in the 3 o'clock afternoon when everyone is going for it.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Mark. It's hard to overstate how important magnesium is for all aspects of our health. There's a long list of symptoms and diseases that can be treated or even cured with magnesium. It's my favorite mineral. In fact, way back when I was an ER doc, magnesium was a critical element of our care. We used it to treat all sorts of things like arrhythmias, to constipation, to preeclampsia, even seizures in pregnant women. So it's really essential to our health and well-being. And yet over 80% of the population doesn't get enough magnesium on a regular basis. And 45% are probably really deficient. Now, this is a problem because magnesium deficiency can increase your risk of all diseases and keep you from performing optimally. But even more critically, there's not just one type of magnesium. There are 7 different types that we need in our diet to ensure both our health and our vitality remain strong. I'm normally a big advocate of getting as many of your nutrients as you can through a well-balanced diet. But in this case, it's almost impossible to get magnesium through your food alone because our soil is so overworked and mineral depleted, and we don't have enough organic matter to extract the minerals like magnesium from the soil. So it's a problem. Fortunately, Bioptimizers has a solution. The Magnesium Breakthrough Supplement is the only product on the market with all 7 types of magnesium, and it's specially formulated to reach every tissue in your body to provide maximum health benefits. Bioptimizers Magnesium Breakthrough gives you access to the full spectrum of magnesium, which can dramatically improve your overall health, from reducing stress to improving sleep and boosting your energy levels. From now until November 29th, Bioptimizers has a special offer of 25% on all their products. Just go to bioptimizers.com/Hyman. That's bioptimizers.com/Hyman and enter the code Dr. Hyman, DrHyman, to activate this exclusive offer, which is only for a limited time. I know a lot of you out there are practitioners like me, helping patients heal using real food and functional medicine as your framework for getting to the root cause. What's critical to understanding what each individual person and body needs is testing, which is why I'm excited to tell you about Rupa Health. Looking at hormones, organic acids, nutrient levels, inflammatory factors, gut bacteria, and so many other internal variables can help us find the most effective path to optimize health and reverse disease. But up till now, that meant you are usually ordering tests for one patient from multiple labs. And I'm sure many of you can relate how time-consuming this process was, and then it could all feel like a lot of work to keep track of. Now there's Rupa Health, a place for functional medicine practitioners to access more than 2,000 specialty labs from over 20 labs like Dutch, Vibrant America, Genova, Great Plains, and more. Rupa Health helps provide a significantly better patient experience, and it's 90% faster, letting you simplify the entire process of getting the functional medicine lab tests you need and giving you more time to focus on patients. This is really a much-needed option in functional medicine space, and I'm so excited about it. It means better service for you and your patients. You can check it out and look at a free live demo with a Q&A or create an account at rupahealth.com. That's rupahealth.com. Now, let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy. Welcome to The Doctor's Pharmacy. I'm Dr. Mark Hyman. That's Pharmacy with an F, a place for conversations that matter. And if you ever worried about maintaining your function as you get older, about avoiding the disease of aging, about living to 120 and being able to do whatever you want, this conversation is important to listen to because it's with one of the world's experts in muscle, and which is what you need and is the currency of aging. It's Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, who's a good friend. She's a graduate of Washington University, fellowship-trained physician in nutritional science and geriatrics. She's also the founder of the Institute for Muscle-Centric Medicine. We're going to talk about what that is. She has a private practice that services leaders, innovators, mavericks. I take her advice personally. She also is really amazing in terms of her work with the military and special operations military for the special ops forces who struggle with different issues. And her goal is to change the paradigm of medicine from obesity-focused medicine to muscle-centric medicine and change the way we think about health and medicine with high scientific integrity. And she's my go-to protein and muscle person. So welcome, Gabrielle.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's really fun to get to have this conversation because actually you and I have had the muscle protein conversation for close to a decade now. And
yeah,
that
right.
is
it's true.
Hilarious.
It's true. I've learned a lot from you. So Let's get right into it. You know, I just finished my book called Young Forever. I finished writing it. It's coming out in February 2023. And in researching it, I really had to dive deep into this question of protein and muscle. And it's a highly controversial subject, believe it or not, because the science is not that controversial. But it's very controversial when it comes to nutritional circles. Before we sort of get into the controversy, I want to just get down to the basics about why muscle is the most overlooked organ when it comes to our health, why it's overlooked when it comes to our metabolic health and obesity, and it's in how it impacts everything from how we regulate our blood sugar to how well we age, and why it's such an important organ when it comes to longevity. So talk about why it's important to our overall health and why it's important to longevity and why it's been this long forgotten organ.
Yes. Skeletal muscle. And when we think about skeletal muscle, that is the muscle that we have under voluntary control. You can go and exercise, you can think about it, and you can contract it. Now, skeletal muscle is the most underappreciated organ. That's right. It is actually an organ system, despite the fact that we think about it as it relates to locomotion, as it relates to exercise. It's so much more significant than that, even though, of course, that is of critical importance. Skeletal muscle is the organ of longevity. And I can't wait to tell you about what I mean when I say that. It is our
primary. You don't have to wait. You can get right into it.
Yeah. Here I go. So muscle, when you think about muscle, I think about it really in a few different domains. Number one, as it relates to diseases of aging that we're seeing. And when I say diseases of aging, I'm really talking about metabolic disease and then subsequently sarcopenia. So metabolic disease, for the listener, we're really talking about type 2 diabetes, obesity, components of cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, which we talk about is type 3 diabetes of the brain. And overall, insulin resistance, which is the hot topic. And insulin resistance simply means that your body requires more of an output of insulin from the pancreas to move glucose into the cell. Now, we're like, well, what does this have to do with muscle?
Yeah, exactly.
And I will get to that. What if I told you that muscle is one of the primary sites for insulin resistance?
Yeah.
If we believe that insulin resistance is at the heart of these diseases that subsequently cause type 2 diabetes and then obesity, then really skeletal muscle is the focal point. It's the pinnacle, not the periphery. So from a very tangible aspect, skeletal muscle is the site for upwards of 80-some% of glucose disposal, meaning the carbohydrates that you eat, the primary initial site of disposal is skeletal muscle. It's also a primary site for fatty acid oxidation. You know, you and I were talking earlier about mitochondria. We think about fatty acid oxidation as a way of generating energy, as a way of utilizing fatty acids in the bloodstream, moving and generating just overall energy. So glucose disposal, fatty acid oxidation. These are really the big things that when I think about skeletal muscle, I think about the importance of them. And then as we age, as individuals age, we see a decrease in the capacity of skeletal muscle. It becomes, like I had mentioned, you know, I talk about this in the range of aging, but the reality is if you are sedentary, skeletal muscle metabolism, skeletal muscle defects can begin in your 30s, right? These diseases that we think about as aging actually happen much earlier. And the concept that a sedentary, you know, in the data, in a lot of the research, it says sedentary, healthy sedentary, there's no such thing.
I don't know where it says that. I haven't read that.
It does. You will see studies that say this is a healthy sedentary population. And this is what this study has done. And the reality is our bodies, the homeostatic mechanisms in our body were designed for physical activity. Our genes, the way in which we utilize nutrients, all of this was designed to piggyback off of skeletal muscle metabolism and use.
We had to use our bodies to survive, right?
Way
we had
more,
to lift stuff, run, catch stuff, kill stuff, hunt stuff.
Yes.
You know, pick up stones, logs, right?
Right.
So that's basically
you don't do anymore. Mm-mm. Yeah. So we don't do this anymore. And one of the primary defects, I believe all of these issues really start to begin in skeletal muscle decades before. Decades before we start to see elevations in blood sugar, decades before we start to see issues with insulin resistance, because for a period of time when we're young, we're able to really leverage our youth, right? That wave of youth to be able to account for some of these excess carbohydrate consumption, excess calories. And these are things that we have to really, really, really be aware of. And as we age, the muscle has the tendency, right? Because if we get injured, over a lifespan, it does become more insulin resistant, and it takes on physiological changes like anabolic resistance, which I know we're going to talk about.
We're going to talk really, about that. That's an interesting one.
How muscle is a nutrient sensing organ.
Yeah. We're going to get to anabolic resistance, which is basically the idea that as you get older, it's harder to build muscle. So there's hacks you can do to fix that problem and stay well muscled well into your, late life, even over 100 years old. So we're going to talk about that. I met a guy in Sardinia named Pietro, who was 95 years old. The guy was so fit. I was like, holy cow, this guy's like climbing up and down mountains, herding his sheep. And I'm like, this is just incredible, because you don't see this kind of physical fitness in the average 95-year-old in America. Right. It doesn't mean it's not possible, but it's really interesting. And so one of the things I want to get into is this whole idea of protein. Somehow we've gotten off track when it comes to understanding protein in this country. There's recommendations based on dietary guidelines about how much protein we should eat. It doesn't really talk about the kind of protein or the quality of the protein, right, or where it comes from or what it does to your body or how it works metabolically. But it's really a really important thing to understand the history of protein recommendations and why they really are not meeting the needs of most people today.
Yeah, I think that is a really, really great place to start. And before I came on here, I pulled up a couple of stats for you, because I know you love stats. And I want to say that when we talk about aging, we have to think about what actually kills people. And for 65 years and older, the leading cause of death is a fall. So I'm just going to say that's the leading cause of death. And that really directly relates to skeletal muscle. Yeah. Next, we have to think about 50% or so of women over the age of 50 eat less than the RDA of protein, which is 0.8 grams per kilogram. So that's
Stop there. 50% of women don't
over
eat
over the age of 50. It's actually
over the age of 50.
This is actually 52%. So 52% of women over the age of 50 eat less than the RDA, which is 0.8 grams per kilogram.
Okay, so the RDA means what? Because people think that's all the protein they need is what the RDA says right. You need. But that's not actually true.
That's not actually true. So protein, the RDA for protein is a recommended dietary allowance. Now, that is 0.8 grams per kilogram. And, that number hasn't changed, by the way, since the 70s.
Yeah. So
that means one of two things. Number one, we haven't had any new research come out that perhaps would mean that the recommendation should or should not change. Or number two, protein in and of itself is really a ignored macronutrient, and fat and carbohydrates have really taken over the limelight. So it's one of two things.
But the RDA, just basically my understanding of it is it's basically the minimum amount you need to not get a deficiency disease. So how much vitamin E do you not need to not get scurvy? 30 units. How much do you need to not get osteoporosis and have good mental health and immune function? Probably 4,000, right? So that may be 10 times that amount. I mean, I don't think you need 10 times the RDA of protein, but what's at the heart of that RDA? Because I think that's key to people. Because they say, oh, at 0.8, that's easy to get.
Right. And let's leverage that. So 0.8 grams per kilogram is really the bare minimum to prevent deficiencies. And this was based on these old school nitrogen balance studies. And it was originally for animal husbandry to figure out how much protein was needed to grow or raise an animal, right? So what was the cheapest way that they could do it with the highest amount of carbohydrates, the lowest amount of protein, to still have some minimal growth and turnover for that animal? Then, so number one, it's not an optimal number, and it really is based on the bare minimums. When they started looking at humans, they looked at 18-year-old men. And this was really during wartime is when a lot of the discussion really picked up. And by the way, nutritional controversies and dietary protein recommendations have been a source of contention since the 1800s, right? So this has been something that has been going on for quite some time. Now, I will say that the recommended dietary allowance is the bare minimum to prevent deficiencies. So what does that translate to someone who is listening? Well, as you said, for some of the other micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, let's take vitamin C, for example. The vitamin C recommendation is 60 milligrams or so a day. That is the minimum amount to prevent deficiencies.
Scurvy.
So the second Mark gets sick, I guarantee you he's taking 1,000 milligrams.
Yeah, or more.
On the flip side, you know what I mean, right? Like maybe more, maybe less. But on the flip side, when someone is going through, say, a catabolic crisis, or let's say they hurt their back, or, you know, you now have pneumonia or some injury, or say you're just not feeling well, the individual doesn't think, oh, well, I'm going to bump up my protein because that's going to help my body recover. It's going to help my immune system. It's going to help with all the tissue turnover that I need. And this is a really big important flaw of our thinking, in that for every other nutrient, we think about the RDA as a minimum. Everything else. So when we think about 150 grams of carbohydrates, or when we think about a fat, we always think in terms, and I say this in absolutes, perhaps it's not in absolutes, but it's really thought about as a minimum for everything else except for protein. And I want to lead into something else. So there's something called the acceptable macronutrient range. And right now, that recommendation for protein is between 10 and 35%. Mm. Wait, that's a huge range. So let's break it down.
Right? 10% or 35%. That's a big jump.
From 10 to 35%. So let's break that down for an individual, right? So if we have someone who's having 1500 calories and they're at the low range of the acceptable macronutrient range, then they're going to get 37 grams of protein. Okay, so
they're now meeting
their need. But then if they're at the high end of the range, 35% or so, they're going to get 131 grams of protein.
Yeah, that's a big range.
It's a big range, and it creates a lot of confusion, which is where my work, I believe, is very valuable. And my job is, how do we teach people to protect their skeletal muscle in a aging population? Because the reality is we all are aging, and there's very specific protein recommendations. Again, it doesn't talk about macronutrient distribution. It doesn't talk about how much protein you need per meal, which becomes more important as you age. It really just talks about this overall 0.8 grams per kilogram in some nebulous term.
Yeah. So just to sort of summarize it, basically the idea is that these protein recommendations are old. They haven't been updated, and they are reflective of the minimum amount most people need to not get a protein deficiency, not the optimal amount necessary to build muscle. And it doesn't reflect what you need at different stages of your life, which
also
are changing, right? And it doesn't talk about the quality of the protein. So let's get into talking about what matters when it comes to eating protein to build, preserve, and keep your muscle healthy. Because that's something that most people don't quite understand. They go, I think I'm eating a low-carb diet, I'll lose weight, or I'm going to have a higher fat diet, I'll be good for keto. But like, what actually is going on with the protein that we truly need to build muscle? And I've learned a lot about this from you in terms of how much you need per meal, what the amino acids are that are relevant for building muscle, where they come from, and address some of the controversies there. Because I think we're in a lot of myths are out there around dietary protein. And there's some pretty strong opinions out there. I mean, if you, just in terms of the kind of vegan world, there's some very powerful movies out there that are, you know, seem to be very scientific, like What the Health and Game Changers, that would make you believe that you should be able to get all the protein you need from plants, and that actually is a better source of protein, and that it works just as well. And then you could, you know, basically lift up a car and look like Arnold Schwarzenegger by eating vegetables and beans and grains. But you have an issue with that. So I'd love you to sort of break it down for us and help us kind of navigate some of these myths and figure out what the truth is in the sciences.
Yeah, certainly. So when we talk about protein, we're really talking about amino acids. And for humans, we're looking at 20 different amino acids, 9 of which are essential. An essential amino acid means that you must get it from the diet. You must eat it. And these amino acids are needed in different amounts. And one of those amino acids is particularly important in building muscle. And by the way, the body requires all amino acids to build muscle, not just the essential. We really need all the amino acids. And out of the essential amino acids, we're really talking about, you know, from my perspective, are the branch chains. And that is leucine, isoleucine, and valine. The branch chain amino acids simply relate to the shape, the structure of the amino acid. And this is where protein quality, that concept of protein quality, comes in. Protein quality is not a questionable term. It's not an emotional term. It strictly is hard, fast biological numbers, right? It's I'm 110 pounds. I'm 5'1". These are my numbers. A protein quality is determinant on these limiting amino acids, these essential amino acids. When we think about what we consider high protein and good, high quality protein, we're really looking at, again, these leucine, isoleucine, and valine in these essential amino acids. And they are highest in animal sourced foods. What becomes so important, it doesn't mean that you can't get it from plants. You absolutely can. But I remember calculating quinoa numbers because people that quinoa was a big deal, and it came out where quinoa was really important for protein, and this was a great source to get your protein. And really, you're looking at 6 cups of quinoa based on those essential amino acids, and specifically the branch chain, would equal 1 small chicken breast. Because again,
okay, 6 cups of protein.
6 cups of quinoa for one small chicken breast.
Which is probably and like over 1,000 calories compared to like 200 calories for protein.
It's carbicide, right? So it becomes carbicide. So
Carbicide. I never heard that word. What is carbicide? Yeah.
These are very important conversations because the narrative is so loud, you know. And by the way, I have to say the high quality proteins like red meat, the consumption is down 40%, by the way. And we right now eat a 70% plant-based diet right now as is. It doesn't mean it's not ultra processed and processed foods, but the reality is 30% of our diet comes from animal-based products, where, by the way, is where we get the most nutrients, you know, the most iron, most high quality protein. So again, when we think about protein, we have to have a discerning eye and a discerning thought in the way that plant protein simply structurally is different than animal protein. And plants make a appropriate amino acid profile for plants, and animals and animal products make an appropriate amino acid profile in the appropriate amounts for animals.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of what I've come to understand is that if you want to build muscle, you need to eat muscle. Would you agree with that?
In order, you do need protein to build muscle. You do need also exercise. You need resistance exercise.
I just back up a little bit. What I'm asking is, you know, you can eat like a grain or a bean, which has some protein. But if you really want to build muscle, you need to eat other muscle, right? Which is chicken, fish. I mean, chicken, fish, beef. Those are muscles. Those are animal muscles.
Yeah. So the data would support. So Stu Phillips, who you've had on podcast, a very fine scientist. He recently did a study, and you know what it showed was that the strength and muscle gain was similar in younger adults, as long as protein amounts were equal. Now, that doesn't mean that we're talking whole foods, but you know, we're talking about leucine quality and protein amounts that are equal. So could you do it with plant-based proteins? You know, I always try to have scientific integrity in anything that I'm talking about. Do I think that you could build muscle purely on a plant-based diet? Yes. Do I think that that would be optimal? I don't. Do I think that if you are looking for a whole food diet and we have to move beyond just the macronutrients, things like creatine, iron, zinc, carnosine, and serine, all these food matrix components, I think
all those things you mentioned, by the way, are things only found in animal protein.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Creatine and serine, carnitine, right? Carnitine is actually carnivore. That is where that comes from, right?
And the next question is, why is it so divisive, right? You and I, Mark, have been in this space for a long time. I would say 10 years ago when we first met, I don't even think people were arguing about this, at least not on any large scale.
I mean, yeah, for sure.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Mark. I'm excited to share with you a brand that I trust whose product I've seen value in firsthand, Inside Tracker. Inside Tracker is a wellness tracker that uses science and technology to deliver ultra-personalized healthcare guidance. Their cutting-edge algorithmic engine analyzes your blood, your DNA, your lifestyle habits, and then gives you an actionable set of recommendations to help you meet your health and wellness goals. Since 2009, Inside Tracker's science team from Harvard, Tufts, MIT have been bringing personalized nutrition and wellness to the world with a powerful, evidence-based digital platform. Their guiding principle is that your body is unique, so your nutrition, exercise, wellness plans should be too. And that's why Inside Tracker gives you optimal biomarker zones and a customized dashboard to help you change your body for the better. My team tried Inside Tracker and they loved it. They discovered some important things about their health that led them to adopt improvements like taking a vitamin D supplement after seeing they were deficient or eating more iron-rich foods due to low ferritin and hemoglobin and making an effort to embrace stress reduction techniques after seeing high cortisol levels. And not for me, of course. I promise that. If you're curious about getting your own health program that's tailored to your unique needs, I highly recommend checking out Inside Tracker. Right now, they're offering my community 34% off until the end of the month. Go to insidetracker.com/Dr. Hyman. That's Dr. Hyman. That's Inside Tracker, insidetracker.com/Dr. Hyman. And you'll see the discount code in your cart. And now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
I think so let's go back and unpack this a little bit, because I think, you know, what you're saying is really important. There are certain amino acids that are found in higher concentrations in animal protein that are critical for activating muscle synthesis. In order to start the process of building muscle, you need to eat a certain amount. And I think what I've understood is about 2.5 grams of leucine per meal. To actually activate the switch to turn on muscle synthesis.
Yeah.
So if you don't eat that, it tends to turn into just a source of calories, which is terrible, but it's not building muscle.
It's not building muscle. Right. That is accurate. So what you're talking about is something
called. And by the way, what you're saying is in order to get that much leucine, you need to eat 6 cups of quinoa or 4 ounces of chicken.
Right? Yes. 3 ounces of chicken. Yes. It's just not feasible if you are going to try to do it through a whole food based way in which you could do it. Could you do it through soy and other plant isolates? You can. I have concerns over plant isolates over a long period of time. Again, I have no.
So what you're saying, when you mean in English, is if you're eating processed protein powders that come from plants,
they don't
from
exist
pea
in nature.
And soy.
It doesn't exist in nature.
Yeah. And they're jacked up often too.
Yeah, they just don't exist in nature. And over the long term, that concerns me. And again, I just want to say that I'm not against anyone who wants to be vegan or vegetarian. It's completely personal choice, but you can't say that it's healthier for you. And when we are talking about building muscle, the key amino acid really, as you had mentioned earlier, is leucine. And leucine is that branched chain amino acid that is high in things like whey protein and animal. So for every 30 grams or a little over 4 ounces of beef or something like that, you'll get 30 grams of leucine or chicken.
30 grams of protein, not
30
leucine.
Grams of protein. Yes, pardon me. 30 grams of protein, you'll get 2.5 grams of leucine, which really works as a switch, especially midlife. When you're younger, you could get away with a little bit less protein, you know, but when you are older, I like to think of a practical application of 30 grams of dietary protein, 30 grams meaning a little over 4 ounces, to get a robust leucine hit. So what happens with leucine? Yeah.
So just to clarify a little bit, just before you jump into that, to clarify, what you're saying is if you want to be vegan, you can do it, but you need to supplement the amino acids either as a amino acid supplement or with protein powders that are jacked up with extra branched chain amino acids, that you can't just do it with plants alone and eat the quantity of food that's going to require you to that's going to require you to do to actually build the muscle. Is that accurate?
It would be very difficult. That is accurate. And it would be very difficult.
I mean, I can't eat 6 cups of quinoa. I mean, I don't know about you.
Yeah. And then if we translate that over to a younger person.
Cups of beans, right?
We do a real disservice to, say, younger individuals when we take away or say that animal-based products are unhealthy. I think that, you know, when we think about the people that have lower appetites, like an older population, again, I'm a geriatrician by training, they're not eating a lot. So if we say, okay, you're not eating a lot, but I really want you to go vegan or vegetarian, but you really need to consume dietary protein to protect against sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle mass and function, and also to protect your skeletal muscle, I think we really run into problems.
Yeah.
But
so finish what you're saying about sort of the amount of protein and
the amount of protein. Really thinking about the overall protein content of your diet is important. Number one, if we were thinking about the hierarchy, how much are you getting in a 24-hour period? The next most important aspect of understanding dietary protein is really thinking about as a meal threshold. So protein as it relates to a meal threshold amount. And this was done—
Which means how much you need to eat at each meal.
Exactly. Yeah. And this
just,
was
just trying to speak English here because I don't think
everyone's your listeners are savvy. They know. I mean, you guys know. Give me a break. How much protein you need per meal. And actually, this discovery was out of Don Lehman's lab, where he discovered this amino acid. Well, one of his graduate students, Tracy Anthony, really, they discovered that leucine was required in a meal amount, which is an amazing contribution to science. So what does that mean for the listener? That means in order to maintain healthy skeletal muscle, you do want to create a flux. You do want to be able to turn it over. You do want to be able to stimulate this complex within the muscle called mTOR. And mTOR is a mechanistic target of rapamycin that is stimulated by insulin. It's stimulated by amino acids. It can be stimulated by exercise. And really, leucine is the primary driver for stimulating mTOR. And then subsequently, assuming you have all the amino acids, you will be able to lay down new tissue, new protein, generate new proteins.
Yeah. So this is, you just sort of dipped into something that's really important, which is a couple of things I want to get back to. One is, how much protein do you need to eat per meal? Does it matter when you eat it? Can you eat all your daily protein requirements in one meal? Do you need to spread out through the day? And how does that work? So let's kind of tackle that. And then we're going to come back to mTOR, because that just opens up a whole can of worms about aging and longevity.
I'm excited to hear what we land on with this, because you and I have talked about this many times.
Yeah.
How you ingest dietary protein is really dependent on a couple things. Number one, your goals. Number two, your age. And number three, your activity. Okay. Mm-hmm. When I think about dietary protein, and this is what I have seen in the literature, this is what I've seen from, again, my longtime mentor, we collaborate and put together these protocols, is the first meal of the day, whenever you have it, is the most important. Whether you're having it at 8 in the morning or 11 or noon, the first meal after an overnight fast, when you are in a, quote, catabolic, which means a breaking down state, is the most important meal. That is the primary meal to get dietary protein correct, no matter what your goals are. Again, this is my opinion that, and this is what we've seen in some of the studies and our work together, Don's and mine work together, is that first meal of the day is most important. The reason is you're coming off of an overnight fast. Your skeletal muscle, which again, skeletal muscle is the voluntary muscle control, like, you know, are you jacked and tan, what your biceps are, that meal and hitting a minimum of 30 grams of protein, actually upward between 30 to 50 grams, which seems like a lot, but can be very valuable, because not only do you optimize for muscle protein synthesis, because as Mark, as you had mentioned before, it either turns on or it doesn't, but really you want to turn it on and you probably want to max out the system. And to max out the system, you want to push that leucine number threshold up a little bit higher. So between 30 and 50 grams, that first meal of the day is most valuable. And that's also the meal I tend to have a lower carbohydrate amount in, because I really want to focus on dietary protein. Again, can you add carbohydrates? You can if you're training, if it's within your macronutrients range, you totally can.
So this totally explains why 93% of Americans are in poor metabolic health, because the average breakfast in America is a disaster, right? French toast, right. Pancakes, right. Toast, cereal, bagels, muffins. I mean, the sugared coffees people have. I mean, I think people are using a ton of oat milk these days, and people don't realize that
It's called oat juice. I refuse to call almond milk almond milk. It has to be almond juice. You have to call it almond juice.
And it's so high. I mean, some of them are better in terms of their carbohydrate load, but it's like, you have an oat latte, you think, oh, I'm doing something healthy, but actually you're just taking a big load of sugar.
Right.
And so I think that's a big disaster. We don't have typically high protein breakfasts in America. You might have, you know, steak and eggs and bacon if you're, you know, a cowboy, but it's like a pretty unusual to be eating that. And eggs have gotten a bad rap. So people think, oh, I should stay away from eggs. So
this is another really good point that you bring up, is that it's also, so the dietary protein to stimulate muscle, but also the subsequent nutritive effects of the amino acids. Well, dietary protein also will decrease hunger. And there's been fMRI studies that will show that those individuals that have a higher protein breakfast are much less likely to crave later on in the day and or go to the high satiety, highly palatable foods like you had mentioned for breakfast, like the French toast and the donuts later on in the 3 o'clock afternoon when everyone is going for it.
Right. So basically it helps regulate your appetite. Yes. It builds muscle. It prevents you laying down fat. I mean, if
it helps with your metabolism just by the sheer fact of, you know, there's a thermogenic effect of protein.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
The thermic effect of protein really, and I've thought a lot about this because it's very variable in the literature. And I believe it's variable because when people are under consuming protein, they don't hit enough protein to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. When you hit enough protein to stimulate muscle protein synthesis, that's where you get that real thermic effect of food, where it actually takes energy.
Yeah. So this is a really important concept. So basically, some foods take more energy to metabolize.
And utilize.
In other words, you have to process protein and it actually uses more energy. I wrote about this in Ultra Metabolism like almost 20 years ago.
And that
was so clear to me that if you eat protein, you actually get this thermic effect, which is kind of like a bonus. You could literally lose pounds and pounds and pounds simply by choosing more protein calories than carbohydrate calories.
And right? You know, what's really interesting is that, and this is, Stephen Simpson's work, and that's the protein leverage hypothesis. And basically, what he reported was reducing protein from 18% to 13% of the diet, which is not a huge, so you're talking just a few percentage increase, a few percentage decrease from 18% to 13%, that this can lead to a 10% increase in overall calorie consumption. The body will drive to eat dietary protein. There is a driver because we need it. We must, again, it's essential. Carbohydrates are not essential. Fat, there's some fatty acids that are essential, but protein is arguably the most important macronutrient for aging and longevity and muscle health.
Yeah. So just to kind of summarize, basically quality matters. You need to have either jacked up processed vegan protein powders to meet the needs, particularly as you age with extra leucine, which, you know, has problems in and of itself when you're eating a processed food and who knows what that's going to do to us. Two, you need to make sure you have plenty of protein in the morning after your overnight fast. Three, it's good to spread your protein out throughout the day. And four, we need more protein than we thought, probably like 1.2 to 2 grams per kilo. Mm-hmm. So like for the average person, you say 30 to 50 grams. What is that? That's like 3-4 ounces of chicken, 6 ounces,
yeah, just about 8 ounces of steak. So for 1 gram, for 1 ounce, there's about 7 grams of protein. So,
right. So if you're bought 50, you need like 7 or whatever, right?
Yeah. So seven. Yes. So exactly. Yeah. And this is where, you know, again, you can use yogurt, you can use eggs, you can use whey protein. Can you use some plant-based sources? As long as you're having a higher quality protein, you can. But again, it's just making sure that you're meeting that amino acid threshold. And it's just much easier to do with animal products. Could you do it from a whole food vegan diet? Probably. Just the amount of food that you would consume, it would require a lot of activity.
Yeah, one of the things I've found very effective is I do my workout in the morning and then I use goat whey. And I can get fairly high concentrations of protein using goat whey in a shake. So I tend to use this goat whey, one, because I think it's probably got less of the A1 casein that can be in regular goat whey, because there's still some casein in whey, and because it's likely to be more regeneratively raised and so forth. So I think there's reasons I do it. I tolerate it better. I don't have any issues with it. If I have regular whey, sometimes I have issues with it. Do you think whey protein is a really a good hack for people?
I do.
And is it good as you age?
I do. And we know that there is a lot of research out there utilizing whey protein with an older individual, with older individuals. It's interesting. I say older individuals. Is that defined as 65 or above? Or, you know, is it perhaps?
I'm going to be 63 soon. So this older is like 90, I think, you know.
Right. So whey protein is really good because it also has immunoglobulins. There's other food matrix components to whey above and beyond just the macronutrients. But, again, we don't really eat for protein. We eat for those amino acids. And that's where the guidelines have kind of gotten wrong, because if you look at the label, you look at the back of a label and it just says protein, but it doesn't say the amino acid profile. It doesn't say the quality of the protein. So long story short, yes, whey protein is very valuable. I think it's a great, quote, hack for an individual, for sure. And it's really easy to tolerate and use. It's a great way to get protein up.
So I want to touch on a couple of things. One thing next I want to talk about is mTOR. And then I want to talk about the controversy about meat being bad for your health. Like, it could be good for your muscle, but is it bad for your health? And is it bad for the environment? So yes. I think most people believe that meat is unhealthy. And I think I see this over and over because I get asked about this all the time. Mm. And I think the general consensus out there in the public is, and I think part of this is due to very good PR campaign by certain subsets of the population who believe that eating meat is bad for you and bad for the planet. Right. So that's really important. Now, ethically, if people have a moral issue around killing animals, I have no problem with that. And I have many Buddhist monks as patients. That's okay. I don't have any discussion about that. But in terms of the science around planetary health and human health, I want to get into that. But before we do that, I want to kind of keep on this track of aging. And I just finished my book called Young Forever, and it was so clear to me that maintaining muscle mass as we age and preventing sarcopenia is so key to maintaining our metabolic health, our sexual health, our hormonal regulation, our brain health, and our functionality and our ability to do whatever it is we want to do as we get older. So the question that keeps coming up within this community is, I see a lot of actually longevity experts, like the top scientists, talk about how you should be vegan in order to promote longevity. And it's sort of shocking to me because they're saying they want to do this because it induces autophagy. It doesn't stimulate mTOR like traditional protein. Now, mTOR is this switch. I call it one of the longevity switches. It's a nutrient sensing switch for those listening that detects the amounts of amino acids and sugars in your blood and then responds to those. If there's none, it actually inhibits mTOR, which then starts this process of self-cleaning called autophagy, which is essentially the idea that we're going to live longer if we can have our recycling and cleanup crew working more often. And I agree, that's really important. But at the same time,
which do you think is more important, having muscle mass as you age?
Well, I think it's a false argument, right? It's a false argument because you don't have to choose. I don't think you have to choose. I think you can live and eat in a way that stimulates autophagy and also eat and live in a way that increases mTOR activation to build muscle. So it's like you need the demolition crew and you also need the construction crew. And so, so let's talk about that from your perspective about this sort of controversy about limiting protein and particularly animal protein in order to inhibit mTOR, which is key to aging. And it's true, when you inhibit mTOR through whether it's calorie restriction or whether it's through rapamycin or other strategies, it actually does extend life and address a lot of the diseases of aging and the hallmarks of aging. So can you kind of walk us through from your perspective as a muscle-centric scientist and physician?
And a trained WashU trained geriatrician.
And an expert in longevity and aging.
Okay, so let's you mentioned.
By the way, for those of you who don't know, Washington University is like one of the top medical schools in the world. So you might have heard of Harvard and Stanford, but WashU is right up there.
So longevity experts, you mentioned longevity experts, and I would say longevity experts, especially those in the public right now, are very mechanistic. You may hear the conversation. So I think it's really important that we set the stage of where the information is coming from. So longevity experts, typically rodent models, I don't know, any randomized control, human trials, mechanistic data from individuals who are interested in the mechanisms of longevity. Now you show me the geriatricians and the experts in sarcopenia and the experts in muscle and aging, where any of them are arguing to restrict dietary protein because of mTOR. Mm. I would say none of them would say that. And I would say that there are multiple randomized controlled trials that support optimal dietary protein above and beyond the RDA. In fact, there's multiple papers. I know there's a position paper, which I've sent you, you know, the ProDH paper, but there's multiple other papers that will always show that individuals that have more than the RDA, 0.8 grams per kilogram, more than the RDA will have better body compositions, maintain lean muscle mass, have better blood pressure, all, you know, lower metabolic syndrome, lower fasting triglycerides, all of these things. So I think it's really important for your listener to understand longevity expert mechanism and in the trenches, geriatricians, sarcopenia experts, and muscle experts who perhaps have not infiltrated the space yet. So that becomes very important to understand. So,
but you're changing that.
I'm working on it. I am working on it, right? Because I've seen it. And I also am trained in nutritional sciences, which is, again, very different when you are trained in nutritional sciences and a physician versus looking at, you know, it doesn't take away from these very fine career scientists. But I think that the conceptually, we're really missing the mark. And in fact, when we think about mTOR, again, this is one mechanism. So if people are afraid of red meat, and we'll get back to that, the question is, what is the mechanism of action that, quote, red meat is so bad? You have to tell me, can't be TMAO for those that are interested. It's like,
wait, before we get into the meat bad, good thing.
Fine.
I want to go back to the mTOR thing.
All right, let's talk about mTOR.
We got to unpack this a little
bit.
Okay, so mTOR, I think it's a Goldilocks problem. You don't want to stimulate it all the time.
Correct.
But you also don't want to inhibit it all the time.
I agree.
So how do we do it in a way that one actually gives us time for autophagy and self-cleaning, which I do think is critical for longevity.
But what are other ways to do autophagy?
Exactly. Okay, right. We'll get into that. And then what is the right amount and timing of protein to stimulate mTOR to build muscle, right? Mm-hmm.
These are great questions. Let's talk about mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin, which you called was a longevity switch, and absolutely important and valuable, and it is maintained within our tissues. It's actually mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin, is in every tissue. It is in the brain, in the pancreas, the liver, skeletal muscle. What is so fascinating about mTOR is that it's exquisitely sensitive to different stimuli depending on the tissue it's in. Mm-hmm. So skeletal muscle is exquisitely sensitive to leucine and dietary protein. The pancreas and the liver are more sensitive to increased levels of insulin, which come from increased levels of calories and carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. So you're with me so far?
Yeah, I'm with you.
So the question becomes, if mTOR is in every part of the body, right? It's been maintained forever. Wouldn't it make more sense that when we think about like diseases of aging and things like cancer, which are related to obesity, you know, 40% of cancers are related to obesity. Wouldn't it make sense that perhaps we really focus on excess carbohydrates, excess calories, because that is, you know, we're looking at pancreas, liver, and all these other organs versus skeletal muscle, which is particularly sensitive to amino acids. By the way, mTOR stimulation in skeletal muscle is also sensitive to resistance exercise, which means resistance exercise stimulates mTOR. So if you believe that mTOR is bad because protein, then you have to believe exercise is bad because the pathways are the same.
Yeah. So just to kind of dumb it down for me, because I like really simple guy, I think it's important as I begin to think about this to go, okay, wait, if I basically take time away from eating at all, right? Like if I give myself 12 hours overnight, which is everybody should be doing, right? Like it's called breakfast, right? If you eat dinner at 6 and you eat 6 in the morning, that's 12 hours. If you eat dinner at 6 and eat breakfast at 8, that's 14-hour fast. If you do it at 10, that's a 16-hour fast. If you give yourself that time, it allows your body to activate these ancient longevity switches that help us to prevent longevity-related diseases and addresses the hallmarks of aging. I really think that's true. But then when you are eating, you need to actually make sure you're eating the right amounts and types of protein to activate mTOR, right? Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say. And also what you said as well that was really important is that You don't want mTOR to be going on all the time, right? You don't want to be eating these small meals that are high in carbohydrates. Those are things that, or even small meals throughout the day that are high in protein, right? You don't want to be stimulating mTOR all day long.
So the idea of like eating 5 or 6 or 7 times a day.
You don't want to be doing that. I would agree with that.
Snacking is one of the worst things that ever happened to America. It's just unbelievable. I mean, I've been to all the sort of, longevity zones and just like nobody snacks. Like there's no snack food. It's like an American invention to sell more crap and more processed food.
Yeah. So I would agree that the idea is that you stimulate this mTOR, this mechanism, whether it is for muscle protein synthesis or just by eating, because essentially you do, over discrete meals. It shouldn't be snacking. It should be ideally, I can appreciate individuals wanting to eat 2 meals a day. I think that 2 meals a day would be enough to maintain skeletal muscle health, assuming that you're optimized that first meal and that last meal of the day. So you're pushing mTOR stimulation up, those 2 meals of the day, and then you can have a smaller meal midday if you need, but that would be perfectly adequate.
Yeah, correct. Great. Okay, so I think we answered that question. It's a Goldilocks problem. It's not good or bad. It's about how much and when. So let's talk about health. We can have great amounts of muscle, but are we going to get heart disease and cancer and diabetes and all the things that people say from potentially eating too much animal protein?
I haven't ever seen that data. And in fact,
I'm just asking.
I think that when...
What is the prevailing view, right?
It is. But when you actually look at, say, the risk ratio or their hazard ratio, let's say you were to look at the risk ratio of disease and cancer or meat and cancer, they're insignificant. So in order for something to be significant, it has to have a risk ratio above 2. And none of the data supports that. It's just not significant. I think the things that we know that can really affect health span are smoking, obesity, a sedentary lifestyle, style versus something that is so nutrient dense, like dietary protein. We've really missed the mark. And if people are concerned about autophagy or proteostasis or mitophagy, there are other ways to do it while protecting skeletal muscle, like you said, through exercise, through calorie restriction. These are means, or even cyclical protein restriction. These are means to perhaps augment, quote, these buzzwords like autophagy. But, you know, as we age, we have to be very careful. You are up against a lot. And the reality is you have to plan for collision with the enemy. And the enemy could be an illness. The enemy could be something that is outside of your control. So you must really optimize for skeletal muscle mass. You must do strength training. And, you know, the only way to improve muscle mass health is through exercise and dietary protein.
Mm-hmm. So basically that's the key. You've got it. Not just, the way I explain it to people is like, if you want to make soup, you need to put all the ingredients in the pot, but then you got to turn on the heat.
So basically the heat
is exercise. If you put all the protein in a pot and you don't do any exercise, it may not have the benefits you want. It'll still help to some degree, but I think the key is the timing of exercise and the kind of exercise that we're doing. And that is really critical to muscle health. So strength training, resistance training is so key. Also, interval training, which is really jacking up your intensity so that you kind of stimulate your mitochondria to function better. So that's really key. Let's just talk about protein quality for a minute, not in the view of vegetable or animal protein, but even within animal protein. Are they all created equal? Is a grass-fed cow or a feedlot cow the same, or a wild animal the same as a feedlot cow or a grass-fed cow? And what's your perspective on the quality and where we get our animal protein from?
I will say that there are number one, we have an entire globe to feed, right? So the reality is we have a lot of people to feed. So I want to say that. So I, while we're talking about dietary protein, the quality, I acknowledge the fact that we are very lucky to have the capacity to eat high quality protein. When it comes to the majority of cattle, the most cattle is raised from small farms. It just is. The reality is the majority of cattle is from small ranch farms. And then the next question is, grass-fed versus, or conventional feedlot raised. And I would say typically the animals go to feedlots for finishing. From a dietary perspective, am I concerned? I am not necessarily concerned from a nutrition perspective. I think the high quality protein would rank number one. And I don't want people who say financially are, you know, struggle. I want them to eat high quality protein. So whether it's conventional or organic, I'm okay. Again, maybe there's a difference in omega-3s. That might be variable. But again, maybe you're not eating beef to get your omega-3s. Maybe you'll take a supplement. The next question would be, you know, of course, then we think about regenerative farming and how can we contribute to that? And that's all very valuable. But I really want to have the listener in mind is that, you know, these kinds of meats are very expensive. So
For now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, you know, my first calculator was over $100 and my first computer was $3,500 for 4 megabytes of hard drive and 1 megabyte of RAM. So I think we'll get there. And I'm working a lot in the food system and to kind of support regenerative agriculture. And I think it's going to happen, but it's just going to take time. So I want to get into the conversation that you're really creating, which is why we need to shift from an obesity focused narrative about medicine, weight loss, and move to a muscle-centric version of our thinking about medicine. And it's a very different idea than most of us were trained in. We talk about weight loss. We talk about, you know, the idea of getting fat off our body, but we don't talk about muscle as part of this issue. And it's super important. And if you don't address that, you basically will lose muscle as you lose weight. And then your metabolism will be slower and then you need less calories. So you get in this vicious cycle if you don't understand how to preserve and maintain or even build muscle as you're losing weight. So can you talk about the whole idea of muscle-centric medicine? How do you come up with it? What does it mean? And how does it influence what we have to do, what we have to eat, and how we have to exercise?
The concept of muscle-centric medicine really came from a combination of my undergraduate training. So I trained in human nutrition, vitamin mineral metabolism at the University of Illinois with Dr. Donald Lehman. And then obviously residency. And then I did a fellowship. So I did a postdoc after I completed my residency in nutritional sciences and obesity medicine and geriatrics. So it was a combination research for 2 years in combination with clinical responsibilities, a medical trained, you know, a medical training fellowship with geriatrics and obesity. And we were working on a study, and the study was looking at the body composition and brain volume. It was looking at, you know, what were some of the brain changes that we would see within obesity. And it was really interfacing the concept of type 3 diabetes. And Mark, you've known me for many years. I am a very warm and loving person. I became very attached to some of the participants that I felt very much personally responsible for them. And there was one woman who was just an amazing woman. She was a mother of three in her, I don't know, maybe she was her early, somewhere in her 50s. And she was the typical mom who had put herself last and her three children first and her husband first and had struggled to lose 20 pounds her whole life. So she was going through that cycle that exactly what you're talking about. And I had seen, she was one of multiple patients that I had seen like this, right? So I was also running an obesity clinic that we met once a week and we weighed everybody. It was like a whole thing. And I imaged her brain. We did an fMRI study of her brain, and her brain looked like the Alzheimer brain patients that I was working with. So this was obesity. And I felt at that moment, I had this aha moment. I felt that we and I had failed her. I felt that we were looking and constantly trying to chase body fat and this rigmarole of always losing weight and dieting and all this stuff. And obesity wasn't the thing that everybody had in common. Mm. It was actually low muscle mass that everybody had in common.
Yeah.
And I realized that she wasn't over fat. She was under muscled, and that the origins of her problem and the perspective of her problem and the subsequent consequence of her brain looking like Swiss cheese, which was just so devastating to see, was actually a muscle issue first. And I felt very personally responsible. And I began to think, how can I change this conversation? How can I never let something like that happen to another person again?
Amazing. So you know, most of us know, okay, we can get on the scale and figure out our weight, but we don't necessarily have a clear view of how do we determine if we are under lean
right.
or under muscled, right? And I think most people are over fat and under lean. It's not just being overweight. Yeah. And I think the key of measurement is key on here. Now, how do we start to measure this?
Well, traditionally, when we think about skeletal muscle mass, well, number one, unless you're a geriatrician, you're not really thinking about it. You're always thinking about weight.
Hey, I'm a family doc. I think about it.
Yeah. But yes, of course you do. But, you know, typically you don't do the things that we think about in sarcopenia, where we're looking at how many times can you stand up from your chair? How fast can you walk? You know, what's your gait speed? How much can you grip? You know, these are, when you think about it, they're
grip
more
strength, right.
kind of like a geriatric assessment would be in a typical geriatric assessment. But the one thing that actually we don't typically do in geriatrics, and what nobody really does, is they don't look at the ratio of appendicular lean mass. So it's appendicular lean mass, which is the lean tissue on your body, right? So not your trunk, but your arms. And this is one way. Right. It's, you know, your arm, it's your appendix, whatever. It's your appendicular, you know what I'm talking about.
Your arms and legs.
Your arms and legs. And so that is one way, and it's not really commonly used because it's basically, and I have the numbers. It's so, for example, it's a ratio of appendicular lean mass over height squared. Right.
Oh boy.
And no one really cares. And we actually were looking at this. So I have a book coming out, but that book's not coming out till September. And we actually put models in there that we looked at the data. And basically for sarcopenia, and I'll just give you this number, is that anything less than 7 kilograms per height squared is considered sarcopenia. So this is an appendicular ratio. So it's 7 kilograms per height squared for men is sarcopenic. And then less than around 5.5.
And how do you measure the arms and leg muscle?
So great question. So usually DEXA, which people have access to, but it's not as frequent. And then a CT and MRI. These things are not necessarily very easy to access. Another thing that people can do for a weight measurement or for a body composition measurement is a waist circumference.
Yeah.
So that should be, you know, less than half your height.
Yeah.
Waist height ratio.
So I think you just brought up something I think is actually widely available but not used, which is mm-hmm. a DEXA machine. So the DEXA machine is a dual energy X-ray absorbiometry, whatever. Yeah. It's a big mouthful of medical garbage language. Anyway, it's a test we use all the time mm-hmm. to test for osteoporosis in women, and it's a pretty standard test.
Right.
And in the software for the machine, you can mm-hmm. load up a tool that looks at your body composition and the distribution of fat. So when you get on a body composition scale, you can get a rough idea of the body composition, but you don't get a distribution. With the DEXA scan, you can see, is it in your arms and your legs? Do you have a really skinny arms and legs, but a big belly? Or do you have like a lot of fat around your belly, but you still have more muscle on your arms and legs? You can actually tell much more about where the fat is, how much muscle you have, where it is and isn't, through that machine. And I think it should be basically standard of care. It should be like getting a blood pressure. It should be like getting a, you know, blood sugar level or a cholesterol level.
I agree. I'm hoping that it will move in that direction. And then the other-
Because it wakes people up. It freaks them out when you say, oh my God. I'm like, I remember this kid, I as part of this movie, Fed Up, that I was in, about childhood obesity. I met with this kid, this family in South Carolina, and we did DEXA scans on the whole family. And in normal body composition, it should be like 10 to 20% body fat for a guy and maybe 20 to 30% for a woman. And if you're an athlete, it actually may be lower. So I'm like 6% body fat. You're probably, you know, less than 20% body fat is my guess. Yes. Maybe you're like 3%. I don't know. and this kid was like 50% body fat. Right. And he's like, am I going to become 100% body fat? I'm like, no, you have bones. You have some muscle. It's like, yeah. And so it was a shock, and it got him awake to what was happening in his body, which you often, you know, need a little kick in the pants to think differently about your health. But I've seen this happen to people. So I encourage people to seek it out and find somewhere to get a DEXA scan, which is, you know, most imaging centers, most hospitals, most clinics that do this actually have it. You just have to check and see if they have that program for the body composition.
And we do that for every patient. We do that for every patient. We think it's really valuable. And the other, so you make a really good point, is how much muscle is enough? I don't think that we know that. I think that that is still a nebulous concept, because Muscle is very difficult. It's not homogeneous. It's not all the same kind of tissue, really, like fat tissue, whereas muscle has different fiber types depending on your genetics, depending on what you've done. So the tissue isn't uniform, much like fat tissue is. So it's more difficult to assess and look at. But eventually, I think that we will move to, at least I hope, ultimately, at least once a year, we'll do an MRI or a probably an MRI of body composition. And the other thing I just want to mention is you really want to be aware that, you know, there's this concept that being overweight, you carry more muscle. It doesn't mean that it's healthy muscle. Fat can infiltrate into muscle.
Yeah. And when it means happens, like I call it a ribeye steak versus a filet mignon, right?
Exactly. So that's another aspect that becomes very difficult. And then the other thing you mentioned about being on, you know, under muscled is we have to think also about those physical performance and strength measurements. And that can be different for anyone. And, you know, not necessarily the grip strength or, you know, how long you can hang, but really determining, okay, what is your baseline squat? Can you do that? Or what is your baseline leg press or some kind of marker, how many pushups you can do, but also getting in line with knowing yourself and tracking yourself and seeing if there's improvement.
Yeah, for sure. I read a study recently that if you can do 40 push-ups, your risk of heart disease was dramatically lower, right? I couldn't do 10 when I was 50. Now I can do like 75 or 80 at
100.
One go.
We're going to do a push-up challenge. I did a push-up challenge with our friend Sean Stevenson.
He beat me, but okay. Of course. Well, I mean, he's a crazy man. I want to finish up by asking you what your daily routine looks like in terms of diet and exercise and how someone with your level of knowledge and expertise shapes their diet and their day to build muscle and have a muscle-centric life.
Right. I thank you for this question. I fast most of the morning and I'll eat around 11:30, and that will be, I'll eat, say, cottage cheese, or I'll have some 30 gram of protein meal. I'll have cottage cheese. Maybe I'll have some Greek yogurt.
Is it after your workout or before?
Oh, yeah. So I don't eat after I work out. I train heavy 3 days a week. So I train heavy 3 days a week, and I typically do legs. I'll do some kind of full body movement. Maybe it's kettlebell swings or pull up, something like that. But I really focus legs heavy 3 days a week. I've been getting back into CrossFit. I've been going to a place called CrossFit Stealth. So I'm just waiting to hurt myself again. I think last time, who knows? Now that my book is done and my babies are almost two, back into CrossFit, and I'll do that once a week. I like to kind of do some of that metabolic conditioning. So that would be a day where I would do some kind of high intensity interval training. So that's 4 days a week. And then I'll do some kind of zone two cardio training 2 or 3 days a week.
Hmm. But do you eat after you work out?
I do.
So the protein you're talking about is after you work out?
The protein, yes, but it's not immediately after, right? So again, it's depending on your age, it can be within a 24-hour period. I think where individuals really benefit from dietary protein after they eat is depending on if they're older or not. Or, you know, really, I think the data would support if you're younger, as long as it's in a 24-hour period,
then
it doesn't really matter. But as you get a little bit older, or if you are,
what does older mean?
I know.
40, like, I don't know. 50, 60,
I don't know.
70?
I don't know that answer. Yeah. But also, I also think that there's some room that if you're sedentary, so if you are younger with older muscle, and I say older muscle, and I say this lightly, like obese muscle or possibly impaired or having low-grade chronic inflammation, I think that there would be no reason not to eat. So let's say you have a lower anabolic response, which simply means that it's more difficult for you to build muscle. I think if you are one of those people training hard and then potentially not stressing about having protein after, but, you know, if you can, it would be it could be beneficial. I think this is a really important concept, and that if you don't have time for the concepts that we're talking about, so if you say you don't have time to exercise and you don't have time to eat dietary protein, then you better have time for sickness.
my funny slide I often use is, would you have time to exercise an hour a day or be dead 24 hours a day?
That's hilarious, right?
And there is an old quote. It's like, either you have to make, if you don't make time for exercise, you have to make time for sickness. So I think that's right. Yeah. I what's your book called that's coming out?
So the title might change, actually. And called
The Dr. Hyman Diet?
No. Yours is Forever Young, right?
Young Forever.
Young Forever. So I think, so this is a working title. It may be called Forever Strong, but it's title in process.
Like
so Forever
I
Strong,
like
and it will be
like
about the revolutionary science of muscle and nutrition for extraordinary health.
Coming out when?
September 2023.
Okay. We're going to stay tuned for that. I'll have you back on the podcast.
But
we'll
talk it goes about that. On pre-sale. And actually, I have to call you because I have no idea what I'm doing, but it goes on pre-sale in February. So I don't know
Amazing.
If the pre-sale is important,
cool.
but.
Yeah. It's all cool. And you have a great podcast.
Dr. I do. Gabrielle You're going to be on my podcast, as a matter of fact.
So you can listen to that.
It's,
and
you want to know what it's called? You want to know what it's called?
The Dr. Gabrielle Lyons Show. I think it's called
it
that.
It is. And yes, it is. Again, you are going to be a guest to talk about your book. We're going to talk all about this. And guess who is a physician in my practice now?
I don't know.
Brian Stepanenko.
Oh, wow.
Do you know, remember Brian?
Yeah.
Yep. So Brian is former military, great guy. So yeah, so people want to be a patient of mine. They can apply on the website to be a patient. Also very active on Instagram. I have a newsletter, all the things.
Yeah. And definitely check out your website, drgabriellelyon.com. You have a free guide on your protocol. Yep. So that's great. You can get that information. And I encourage you, if you like this podcast, to share it with everybody, your friends and family. Everybody needs more muscle. Leave a comment. How have you actually learned about what works for you in terms of losing weight, building muscle, and how has your diet changed to help you or maybe not? And we'd love to hear from you and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time on The Doctor's Pharmacy. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Hyman. Thanks for tuning into The Doctor's Pharmacy. I hope you're loving this podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do and introducing you all the experts that I know and I love and that I've learned so much from. And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter. And in it, I share my favorite stuff, from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger longer.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.